24. Although he had been argued into submission, Bishop Galbraith refused to take part in confronting Philip, so the wizards set out for the shop on foot. They could have flown or teleported, but it was only a short walk, and none of them, even Martin, was looking forward to getting there. Gwen was in front, and to the outward observer would have appeared to be leading. In reality, she didn't want to walk with the others, and was trying to put some distance between herself and them, which can be a form of leadership. They walked in terse silence. The only attempt at conversation did not go well. Martin quickened his pace to catch up with Gwen, and in a hushed voice asked, in as non-accusatory a manner as he could,
"So why didn't you tell anyone you were a wizard?"
She answered,
"I figured anyone who really deserved to know could figure it out on their own."
It wasn't worded to be a specific criticism of Martin, but he took it as one, and he wasn't wrong.
"But Gwen, if you're deliberately hiding something, you can't be mad at me for not finding it. You have to give a guy some clue."
Gwen stopped dead in her tracks, causing Martin to step out in front of her, then stop awkwardly. Gwen looked at Martin's dazzling reflective silver robe, the robe she made for him, then looked him in the eye and said,
"Plastic sequins were invented in the 1960s.
Gary laughed. Gwen started walking again, faster and angrier than before. Martin watched as she left, and as Gary and Jeff walked past, he looked down at his robe, let out a heaving sigh, and followed behind. Finally, they reached Philip's shop. They entered, filing into the decoy storefront. Martin knew that they'd be unable to enter the next room, with the rune-covered drapes and the crystal, unless Philip was in there already. So he was not surprised when he tried to push through the curtain and found it as immovable as a brick wall. Martin yelled Philip's name a few times. There was no sound. Gary attempted to call Philip on the magic hand phone and got no answer. Martin said he'd check to see if Philip was at home. He disappeared, then a few seconds later he reappeared, shaking his head.
"No, not there. He's got to be upstairs."
The four of them just stared at each other in impotent silence until Gwen rolled her eyes, looked at the ceiling, and yelled,
"Philip! It's Gwen! They know I'm a wizard!"
A moment passed. Then they heard Philip's muffled voice say,
"I'll be right down!"
"Philip knew?"
Martin asked. Gwen said,
"He's not an idiot."
There was some crashing and banging from upstairs, then the sound of heavy, annoyed footsteps coming down the stairs. Finally, Philip emerged through the curtains into the shop. He nodded to Gwen and said hello. Then he turned to Martin and asked,
"What tipped you off? It was the sequins, right?"
Gary laughed, and Martin turned on him.
"You didn't figure it out either."
"Yeah, but I didn't really care enough to try."
Gwen asked Martin,
"What's your excuse?"
Martin turned back to Philip.
"No, it wasn't the sequins. It was when she saved us by scaring off the thug who was threatening to torture us to death."
Philip looked at Gwen, who nodded.
"Yeah, I suppose that'd be a bit of a tip-off. How'd they get your staffs away from you?"
"They crept up and pummeled us from behind," Jeff said.
Gary added,
"We were a bit distracted by all the corpses."
They went on to describe how Gwen had found the now-defunct village of Rikard's Bend and brought in the other three while still trying to maintain her secret. They told Philip about their many attempts to reach him and their arrival at Rikard's Bend. They described in great detail the condition of the bodies they found, the stunted limbs, the lack of shoes. Philip shook his head slightly and muttered,
"Hobbits."
"Yes, clearly hobbits,"
Gwen said. Martin was surprised, since neither he nor Gary had mentioned this theory to her. Then he made a mental note that he needed to stop acting surprised when Gwen knew things. By this time, they had all moved into the crystal ballroom and were sitting around the table. Martin noted that the Commodore 64 was not in its usual spot on the secret shelf in front of Philip's seat, which meant Philip was using it elsewhere, most likely upstairs. Philip ran his fingers through his hair and said,
"Okay, so this is awful. We have a wizard somewhere who tried to turn an entire village into hobbits, killing everyone in the process. We'll have to work together to deal with this. Any suggestions as to what we should do now?"
Gary, Jeff, and Martin looked at each other. Gwen looked at the table in front of her. Martin steeled himself and said,
I think the logical first step, Philip, would be for you to tell us what you're doing upstairs.
After a predictable amount of shocked, angry stammering, Philip downshifted into angry, offended yelling.
You can't honestly think I would do something like this! I'd never dream of such a thing!
I told him you didn't do it,
Gwen said.
And I agreed, Martin said. But you're clearly up to something, and a whole village is dead. Think about that, Philip. You didn't have to look at it like we did, so take a second to internalize it. An entire village of innocent people, killed in one stroke, and it was clearly done by a wizard who was trying to turn them into hobbits. We wizards have to police each other because nobody else can do it. You're the one who taught me that.
Oh, I taught you that, did I? Not surprising, since I taught you everything!
Philip's voice rose to a high, wounded whine. His eyes looked like they might pop out of his head.
Martin, I took you in! I'm the best friend you have! I'm your bloody mentor! Does it really seem likely that I'd be a mass murderer?
No, Phil, it seems highly unlikely. That's why we have to consider it. You could say that you're the last person I'd ever suspect.
Philip shook his head.
Oh, Martin, is that it? I seem too nice and too harmless, so I must be hiding some sinister secret, like we're nothing but two-dimensional characters in some bad novel.
I genuinely hope not, Martin said.
Yeah, I bet. Look, kid, what I do upstairs is my business, and that's just going to have to be good enough for you. Now get out of my shop!
Philip rose and pointed at the door. Martin did not stand, nor did any of the others. Martin spoke in a low, sad tone.
Philip, I really am sorry. I don't for a second believe that you would do this, but I'm not the only person who has noticed that you disappear upstairs and refuse to talk about what you're doing up there.
I disappear into the bathroom and I don't want to talk about what I do in there. Does that mean I'm doing something wrong in there, too?
Martin kept his voice flat but arched his eyebrows.
Do you really want to discuss your bathroom?
Philip sat down hard in his seat. He looked around the table.
If I kick you lot out of here, you're just going to go to Jimmy, aren't you?
We don't want to,
Martin said. Philip sneered and shifted his focus to Gary, who shrugged and said,
Just show us what you're up to, man. We won't tell everyone. We'll just take a peek, then we can get on with finding who did this.
Jeff said,
We'll be in and out. We won't touch nothing. We'll be like a cool breeze blowing through your attic.
Philip looked at Gwen, who was still looking at the table. He asked her,
What do you think?
She lifted her gaze and looked him in the eye.
I think you should show us what you've been up to and be done with it.
Philip shook his head.
You know what's sad? I was almost ready to show you anyway.
Philip led them through the curtain and up the stairs. The steps were dark, rough-hewn, unfinished wood. The outer wall was unfinished stone. The inner wall was wood. The first five steps led to a landing where the staircase bent 90 degrees to the right. The first few steps, those that might be seen from the curtains, were the same as those before, but beyond that it was too dark to see. Philip stopped, looked at Martin, sighed in an exasperated manner, then flipped a plastic light switch on the wall. Once his eyes had adjusted, Martin could see that the remainder of the steps were a beautiful, long-grained hardwood that had been treated with some sort of finish which had made them glossy and turned them the color of honey. The outer wall was still stone, but the inner was slightly off-white plaster, with a subtle, bumpy texture. Philip continued up the stairs. The others followed. As their heads rose above the level of the floor, they were able to see the room they were entering. It took a moment to fully comprehend what they were seeing. The entire upstairs was one large room. The floor was covered in the same beautifully finished hardwood as the stairs. Tasteful track lighting and a skylight illuminated clean, white plaster walls. A sofa made of chrome and white leather sat near a black leather lounge chair and matching footrest. Between them was a coffee table made of glass and whitewashed concrete. The walls were decorated with a palm tree rendered in neon and thin black frames supporting angular paintings of beautiful women with smooth white skin, thick black hair, and perfect bodies. There was also a stereo the size of a small kitchen appliance with speakers as tall as Martin and a full-sized arcade cabinet that said Gorf. Philip made a beeline for the corner, where a small glass and concrete dining table and chairs sat next to a built-in wet bar. Philip pulled the cap out of a bottle of whiskey and poured himself a drink without offering one to anyone else. Gary whistled and said,
"I'm totally doing my cave up like this."
Philip said,
"Well, be sure to let Martin know what you're up to, or you might get accused of mass murder."
Martin took no notice. He was preoccupied by what he saw beyond the seating area. A large roll-up door was built into the wall. In the corner, there was a work table with the Commodore 64, modem, and tiny TV displaying the file. In front of the door sat a nearly mint-condition white Pontiac Fiero. Nearly mint because the taillights were not fully assembled. A set of screwdrivers and a drinking glass with screws lying in the bottom told Martin exactly what Philip had been doing when they demanded that he come downstairs. Martin approached the Fiero. It was smaller than he remembered them. But then he hadn't seen one since he was a child. He slowly circled the car, drinking in all of its contours. He bent to look in the window like a teenager peering into the interior of a floor sample at a Ferrari dealership. It looked complete and pristine. Martin knew there were limits on what could be transported back in time. His flimsy kid bed mattress was about the upper limit of what was possible. Clearly, Philip had painstakingly disassembled his beloved car, transported the parts here piece by piece, and reassembled it with great care, more care than was probably taken when it was assembled in the first place. Martin stood up and looked at Philip, who was still behind the bar on the far end of the room.
"This is amazing," he said. "Why didn't you tell me? I could have helped."
Philip said,
"That's the point. I wanted to do it myself. There's a certain pride in looking at something big and complex and knowing you did it without help."
Even if Martin could argue with that, he wouldn't have. A minute ago, seeing what was in this room had seemed like the most important thing in the world. He was willing to suffer any consequences to make it happen. Now he had seen what was here, and it was great, far better than anything he had hoped, and infinitely superior to what he'd feared. Now all that was left was to deal with the fallout and try to repair the damage. Looking at Philip and the faces of his friends, he saw how much damage was done. In that moment, Martin couldn't imagine what he'd been thinking just a few moments before. Gary was sitting in the lounge chair. Gwen sat on the couch. Jeff was studying the Gorf machine with great intensity. None of them were looking at Philip. Martin had taken the lead in making the mess. He'd have to take the lead in cleaning it up. He walked around the nose of the car and slowly approached the bar. Philip watched him silently, holding the glass of whiskey in his hand. When Martin reached the bar, Philip silently reached beneath the bar and pulled out another glass. He glanced at Martin and poured a second glass of Jack Daniels. He picked up the glass, looked Martin in the eye, then quickly downed it himself. He sneered at Martin as he slammed the empty glass down on the bar. Martin said,
"I think I speak for everyone when I say that we're sorry we did this."
"I know I am," Philip said.
"But Philip, you get it, right?" Martin continued. "I mean, I know you're mad, and you've got good reason, but you see why we had to do this."
"No. Honestly, Martin, I don't. I don't understand why you couldn't take my word. All of you, I mean, okay, Martin's only known me a little while, but I've known all of you for years. I thought we were all friends. But the first time someone kills 100 or so people, you lot are the first to turn up at my door with pitchforks."
Gwen turned on the couch to look at Philip.
"None of us wanted to believe it, Philip, but you're the only one we knew who was keeping a secret."
Philip smiled as he said,
"Really, Gwen? I'm the only one you know who is keeping a secret?"
Gwen flushed and quickly turned away.
"You're the only one we knew who was obviously keeping a secret," Jeff offered.
Philip looked poised to yell some more, but stopped. Instead, he finished his first drink, looked into the empty glass for a moment, and said,
"You mean
I'm the only one who is keeping a secret badly.
Well, Martin said, it isn't easy when you've got some jerk living with you.
Agreed.
Jeff turned away from the Gorf machine.
Oh, come on, Philip. That isn't fair. We all thought...
Philip put up a hand to signal surrender and silence Jeff.
We can argue about that later. We have more important business. Somewhere there's a wizard who's killed innocent people, and now that we know who it isn't, we have to figure out who it is.
So, Martin asked, what do we do now?
As much as it pains me,
Philip said,
I think we have to go tell Jimmy.
None of them seemed happy with the prospect. Philip was the only one who was openly hostile toward Jimmy, but Martin was Jimmy's biggest fan in the room, and even he would describe his attitude toward Jimmy as wary. Nobody spoke. The only sound was a distant dog growling.
Man, Martin said, what is the deal with that dog?
I know, right? How long can a dog growl before it just says forget it? Jeff said. Gary laughed.
It's all garar, arar, grrr, like all the time.
How long have you been hearing it?
Gwen asked.
I heard a dog growling back in Rikard's Bend, but it can't be the same dog, can it?
Philip shook his head in disgust.
Oh, yes, proper bunch of detectives you are.
He hastily grabbed his staff, which had been leaning in the corner behind the bar, and stepped around the end of the bar, across the room, to an empty patch of floor in front of the Fiero. He planted the tip of his staff on the floor, then with his other hand pointed to the spot where the staff intersected with the floor. He cast his eyes around the room, then said in a loud, clear voice,
okay, stand here and stay there until I say to move.
Martin started walking toward the spot to do as he was told, but stopped dead when Philip glared at him and shook his head. Philip pulled his staff away and slowly backed off from the spot he'd indicated as if it were radioactive. In three quick steps, he was at his computer. With his left hand, he pointed his staff at the spot he'd indicated. With the other, he typed some commands. A few excruciating moments passed, with nothing but the sound of clacking keys and Philip muttering. Finally, Philip's shoulders slumped and the muttering gave way to cursing. He looked at the empty spot on the floor and said,
hold on, just another second,
then typed in another command and hit enter. Tyler appeared, gasping for air, eyes bulging. He immediately fell to his knees. Gary and Gwen had watched with interest, but now they leapt to their feet. Jeff abandoned the arcade console and ran to where Tyler, breathing deeply and moaning, knelt on the floor. Philip pulled off his hat, said,
Inbote ligita, aquo,
and produced a bottle of mineral water. He handed it to Tyler, who gulped it down at an astonishing rate. Martin remembered his first morning in medieval England, when Philip told him the do's and don'ts of wizarding, particularly the part about getting ghosted, being made invisible. You didn't need food, air, or water, but your body didn't know it. You could still see and hear. You could still move around, but you couldn't interact with anything heavier than a mote of dust floating in the air. The real torture was that you couldn't talk, but you could make faint, spooky noises. So any attempt at communicating would only torment and repel those you tried to contact. Martin knew Tyler had been missing for at least a week, starving, suffocating, and dying of thirst for a week, surrounded by people who would love to help him, but didn't know he needed help. Martin couldn't imagine anything worse. Tyler finished the bottle of water. He remained kneeling on the floor, breathing deeply. He opened his eyes, reached out, and took Philip's staff. He said,
Mi banchambro,
Esperanto for my bathroom, and disappeared. Yep, Martin thought. That's worse. They sat in a sullen, guilty silence while they waited for Tyler's return. Philip poured everyone a drink. Finally, Tyler reappeared. Nobody said a word, nor would they until Tyler broke the silence. He walked to Philip, who was standing by the bar. He handed Philip's staff back to him, then hugged him for a very long time. Finally, Tyler released the hug and said,
Thank you.
Tyler turned to the rest of the group who were seated, but stood up as soon as Tyler returned. Tyler nodded to Gwen and said,
Gwen, a pleasure as always.
She returned his greeting.
He turned to Gary and Jeff, his two best friends, and in a genuine outpouring of heartfelt emotion said,
Damn you idiots, you morons! I'm so mad at you two!
Clearly, words alone couldn't express what he was feeling. He shouted inarticulate rage noises at Gary and Jeff for a while longer. By the time he was done, Philip had produced another bottle of water, which he handed to Tyler. Tyler sat heavily on the couch and took a drink.
I've been growling at you idiots for 12 days, Tyler said between gulps of water. You both read my book. I'd hope spooky growling would make you think of me at least once in all that time.
Martin turned to Gwen and said in a low voice,
Tyler's an author. He wrote a book called The Curse of the Ghost of the Wolfman's Mummy. The monster would make a spooky growling noise.
Gwen nodded and said,
I know, I've read it. Philip loaned me a copy.
That meant that Martin was the only one in the room who hadn't read the book. He thought,
I really do have to stop assuming that Gwen doesn't know things.
Tyler turned to Martin, fresh anger in his eyes.
And you, the new kid, you looked right at me twice. I know you saw me. One time you were so scared you fell out of your stupid hammock.
That was you?
Martin said.
Yes, Martin. The ghostly apparition trying desperately to get Philip's attention was me. I'd given up on ever getting through to Ren and Stimpy over here, and thought I'd try to get the attention of the one sensible adult I know. Thanks again for finally saving me, Philip.
You're welcome,
Philip said as he settled into the lounge chair.
I'm just sorry it took us so long.
They all apologized, even Gwen, who hadn't really done anything. Tyler waved his hand dismissively, which was as close to an apology accepted as they were likely to get. Martin pulled a bar stool over and had a seat. Gary and Jeff followed suit. Gwen sat on the lounge chair's matching footrest. After what he'd gone through, the least they could do was let Tyler have the couch.
So, Philip said, how'd it happen?
Tyler told them that he'd gone to Rickard's Bend to do some more research for the fantasy novel he was working on. When he got there, he bumped into Jimmy. Jimmy had asked why he was there and had reacted with great interest when he learned that Tyler was writing a novel. They talked about the books they'd read and the movies they'd seen. Finally, Jimmy had told Tyler that he had a project he was working on and that he would welcome Tyler's opinion. There were several knowing looks at this. Even Jimmy's greatest detractors had to admit that he was not without his talents, and one of them was making whoever he was talking to feel like the most important, talented, and valuable person Jimmy had ever met. Tyler continued, telling them how he went to Camelot with Jimmy, and how Jimmy showed him plans to gradually remake the people of Rickard's Bend into hobbits.
He asked me if I had any input as an author, Tyler said. I told him he was a monster.
And that's when he ghosted you?
Philip asked.
Oh, yeah. He ghosted me but good. I turned my back to walk away and he flew up behind me, pressed his staff to my back and said the words. At first all I could do was struggle to breathe. I felt like I was dying nonstop until I got acclimated.
How long did that take?
Martin asked.
Hours. I don't know how many. Then I got used to it.
Gwen said,
It's a good thing the craving for air gets better.
I didn't say it got better,
Tyler said.
I just got used to it.
They all considered this for as long as they dared. Martin broke the silence, turning to Philip and asking,
What do we do now?
Philip stood. He looked at the other wizards and said,
We take Jimmy down. We'd better call everybody and get them up to speed. We want to do this right. And by right, I mean in as public and humiliating a manner as possible.